Quavelle was hungry. Her head had ceased throbbing, but the sharp pangs of hunger remained. She put her hands on her belly, surreptitiously examining the chrome bracelet locked tight around her right wrist. A long, slender chain was attached to the bracelet, and the other end of it was secured to an eye bolt in the wall. Standing, Quavelle started going over the area of her confinement in detail. The only furniture was a cot and a chair across the room, near the door. As she paced, she went through her memories of the past few hours, looking for anything useful that her conscious mind might have overlooked, but her subconscious noticed. She remembered the hyperdimensional transition as an onslaught of crazed sensations, wherein she felt sounds, tasted colors, and smelled sights. The patchwork of experiences boiled in her mind like a cauldron of pitch the size of the universe itself. Her awareness slowly returned in bits and pieces and in no particular order. She heard a strange bass hum, as of a musical note refusing to fade, and only then did she become aware of her body again. When Quavelle opened her eyes, the first thing she saw was a rock-ribbed alcove in which she lay. Her first thought was for the safety of the child in her womb, but she sensed nothing amiss. Men in black uniforms pulled her to her feet and marched her through rocky passageways lit by naked light bulbs. Above a certain height, the walls were unfinished stone, but below that they were sheathed in polished alloy. She was escorted past wooden crates, a collection of picks and shovels and other tools, and she guessed wherever she was, the installation was still a work in progress. Quavelle was brought into a cell and chained to the wall. Shortly afterward, a human male, who she assumed was a medic, gave her a swift, almost perfunctory examination. Then she was left alone. Except for the hunger pains, she hadn't minded the isolation. She needed an undisturbed period of time to process what she had experienced, seen, and overheard in order to reach a provisional hypothesis. Judging by the uniforms the soldiers wore, she knew she was a prisoner of the Imperator's forces, but she also knew she was not in the Shan Pyramid. Regardless, the power that had swept her out of the Cerberus Gateway unit and materialized her in the alcove fit exactly with the kind of hyperdimensional manipulation Lakesh attributed to the Imperator. She was fairly certain why she had been abducted, and that knowledge allayed her anxiety to a certain degree. Quavelle stepped to the door, but the pull of the chain against her arm stopped her a foot short of it. She walked in a large half-circle, examining the smooth stone of the floor, looking for loose rock. She found none, so she reached up and grabbed the chain with both hands. She threw her full weight against it, but the eyebolt held without budging even a fraction. Returning to the cot, she sat down and took a deep breath, calming herself. She concentrated on a breathing pattern to control her hunger. Then she felt a stab of sudden fear, and she swung her head up and around toward the door. An instant later, it swung open. Two women walked in, both attired in imperial black. Quavelle recognized both of them instantly. The taller of the women smiled at her patronizingly.
Hello, Quavelle. Are you comfortable?
Quavelle nodded, not speaking.
Answer the Imperial Mother when she asks you a question.
Yes, my Lord Baron.
Quavelle's response was automatic, by rote, but Baron Beausoleil's eyes widened just a trifle in surprise.
You know me?
Yes, my Lord Baron. Both of you. I have seen you at Area 51.
Understanding glinted in Erica Van Sloan's eyes.
Ah, I confess I was unaware of you until recently.
That is to be expected. Until recently, I was just another drone of the Quad V genotype.
Baron Beausoleil came nearer, her eyes never wavering from Quavelle until she was standing right in front of her.
And what are you now?
Quavelle didn't look at her. Instead, she kept her eyes downcast as she had been conditioned to do, fixing her gaze on the Baron's boots.
I appear to be a hostage, my Lord Baron. Or perhaps a lure would be more appropriate.
Or flypaper. Do you know why you are here?
I can only speculate.
Please do.
Dr. Singh informed me of the Imperator's desire to enlist his aid in his undertakings. He feared that if he utilized the Cerberus network, the Imperator would sense it and redirect the matter stream. Apparently, the Imperator took this fear into account and developed a secondary choice.
Quavelle paused.
Do go on.
Obviously, I was that secondary choice. Particularly after it became known I had been impregnated by a human. Due to the signals transmitted by the subdural transponder I was injected with upon my permanent reassignment to Area 51, the Imperator was able to lock in on me during a Mat-Trans dematerialization. Now you expect Dr. Singh to come after me.
No.
Quavel raised her brow arches in surprise. Erica Van Sloan's smile was almost pitying.
Neither I nor my son ever envisioned Mohandas, Lakesh, I mean, gating here to the rescue, offering his services in exchange for your life and that of your child. He is not that gallant.
Quavel nodded.
I comprehend. You expected Cain to come after me, and more than likely Grant, and perhaps even Brigid Baptiste would accompany him. You would have all three of them, as well as myself. Gallantry aside, Dr. Singh would not sacrifice all of them just to save himself. Logical. Almost flawlessly so.
Almost?
You overlooked one important fact. Cain wants nothing to do with me.
Baron Beausoleil frowned.
He is a human male. You carry his child. You love him. Therefore, he feels responsible for you and the child in your womb.
Quavel gazed into the Baron's face.
I do not love Cain, nor does he love me, or feel responsible for me in any way. I am sure if he feels any strong emotion over my abduction, it is relief.
Baron Beausoleil's lips twisted in a sneer.
You are foolish. I saw the vid record of your seeding sessions with Cain. You were completely enamored of him. Your responses were not fabricated.
I did what Baron Cobalt bade me to do. Because I might have learned to take pleasure in the sessions does not mean I love him.
The Baron gazed at her in baffled anger for a long moment. Then she bent over and put both hands on either side of Quavel's face, clasping her tightly.
Show me.
Quavel started to struggle, then subsided. She hastily tried to empty her mind, visualizing an impregnable brick wall around her memories and store of knowledge. A drill bit of pain seemed to bore into the cranial bone at the center of her forehead. She winced.
Your simple defenses are a waste of energy and time. At best, they are a temporary diversion. We are biologically and mentally linked, and you cannot hide your thoughts from me. And even if you manage to resist, I will leave your mind destroyed. You will have nothing, and we will still have you and your child as hostages.
With a sinking sensation of resignation, Quavel realized the Baron spoke the truth. She stopped erecting the mental barrier. Baron Beausoleil's eyes widened and held hers captive, peering deep, deep through them into the roots of her soul. She felt her memories being rifled, examined, weighed, and judged.
Show me.
He helped her off with her bodysuit, peeled it down to her ankles, then lifted her out of it. Naked, they lay with their foreheads touching, and he found his way into her. The pain was brief and gradually melted into a delirious burning of the nerves that began in a part of her she had always believed to be without feeling.
Show me.
The burning filled her entire body, and she cried out, thinking she could not bear so much pleasure without going mad. She pulled him closer, and the bedding beneath her turned a glorious red as her 67 years of virginity ended with a sob from her lips and a hoarse call of release from Maddock. Baron Beausoleil released her, stepping back swiftly, her face twisting in shock.
Maddock?
Quavel trembled, hugging herself as the psionic probe ended. She nodded, not speaking.
Who is Maddock?
The Baron gestured to her to hold off on further questions.
It is Maddock you love?
Again, Quavel nodded.
Is he the father of the thing you carry?
This time, Quavel refused to nod or even acknowledge the question. A thin, cold smile spread over Baron Beausoleil's face.
I understand now. You seek to protect him. Your union was unsanctioned. I am disappointed in you, Quavel. True first love, like any other strong drug, is addicting. And like strong addictive drugs, a true first love always has tragic consequences.
Quavel stared into the Baron's face, keeping her expression composed.
You've shared memories of the man with me. Permit me to return the favor.
An image of Maddox's face flashed into her mind, very brief, but no less horrifying. His eyes stared upward sightlessly. His mouth gaped open and his discolored tongue protruded. Blood glistened on his lips and chin. His features were frozen in a twisted mask of terror and agony. Whatever sort of death had come to him, it had been swift but painful. Quavel shut her eyes against the sudden wave of grief that washed over her brain. She didn't want to see anything more. Baron Beausoleil's voice entered her ears as a taunting whisper full of savage satisfaction.
Have you nothing to say?
Quavel opened her eyes and her pale lips stirred.
Yes.
Speak then.
Quavel regarded her with calm, placid eyes.
I am hungry. Inasmuch as any rescue attempt is in serious doubt, will you bring me something to eat? Preferably something that won't upset my stomach?
Bridget opened her eyes, and at first she saw nothing. She felt a surge of panic, wondering if the interphaser had malfunctioned and struck her blind. But when she shifted her head, she caught a yellow glimmer of dim light. She stirred feebly, and the motion caused sweat to break out on her forehead. Her mouth was dirt dry, she felt feverish, and nausea was a clawed beast trying to tear its way out of her stomach. Gritting her teeth, she lay quietly for a long time, listening to the slow, steady thud of her heart. Then by degrees, she turned her head and again caught the glow of light as she squinted at her surroundings. She lay inside a lean-to made of lashed-together saplings, hardly large enough to accommodate the narrow, very lumpy pallet she was lying upon. It was made of woven reeds that exuded a musty vegetable odor. The booming of drums and the incessant piping and skirling filled Bridget's ears only as a cacophonous clamor without meaning, a confusion of faraway noise and motion. The drumming was steady and regular, almost like the muffled beating of a huge heart, seeming to come from all sides at once. The sulfurous smoke of the many fires drifted around, carried on a light, eddying breeze. Just outside the lean-to, a bonfire blazed. High flames licked from rough-hewed logs, and people danced around them, in time with the throbbing drumbeat and the eerie piping and wailing. The vibrations were like the steady beat of the wings of a great bird. Numerous figures danced near the outer ring of fires, leaping and spinning like dervishes. There seemed to be an equal number of men and women, most of them naked but for knotted loincloths. Sweat glistened on their bare flesh. Dark-skinned, slender but solid of build, and under medium height, all of them possessed the same strong features, although hair color and texture varied widely. Their painted bodies jerked in rhythm to the drums as though the measured beats inflicted muscular convulsions. In their hands, they gripped spears and flattened pieces of wood shaped like extended Vs. With a sense of shock, she realized that the spears were called uwas, and the V-shaped lengths of wood were kalis, and she watched the ceremony from inside a wilga. Domi's soft voice murmured from the darkness.
Chukurpa.
Bridget knew she had said dream time. Bridget sat up quickly, gritting her teeth, silently enduring the brief spasm of vertigo. Hitching around, she saw Shizuka and Domi lying on their sides atop reed mats, breathing deeply and regularly in their sleep. Swiping a gloved hand over her eyes to clear her vision, Bridget looked around for their weapons and the interphaser. Adrenaline flooded her system when she couldn't see her copperhead, Domi's combat master, or Shizuka's swords inside the wilga. Bridget began to heave herself to her feet when the flickering flames struck gleaming highlights on their weapons, bound in a neat bundle just outside the open door. She didn't relax because she didn't see the interfacer. Taking a deep, steadying breath, she tried to remember what happened. Her last clear recollection was the wavering funnel of light fanning out from the apex of the interfacer. If it had been lost or confiscated, then she and her companions were stranded thousands of miles from home. A deep male voice spoke from somewhere close by.
It's safe. Do not fear.
Bridget stiffened in surprise, then put on her poker face as she tried to determine the location of the speaker.
I'm out here.
Leaning forward, Bridget squinted toward the bonfire and saw a man sitting cross-legged directly across from the lean-to. How his voice had been projected so clearly across the many yards that separated them mystified Bridget. Carefully, she eased out of the Wilga, noting the coarse-grained red sand shifting beneath her hands. At the same time, she noted the glow of the bonfire reflected off the metal-walled pyramid resting on the man's lap. The designs on his loincloth were identical to those worn by the figure in her dream. As she moved toward him, she surreptitiously examined his face. It was broad and strong, with a splayed nose, wide, thick-lipped mouth, and overhanging brows. His hair was an unruly black mass confined by a feather-bedecked headband. His near-naked, sinewy body was a warm chocolate in color, underneath layers of bright yellow and red paint. Brigid shivered involuntarily, feeling the pressure of his gaze, but she didn't feel any fear, and that surprised her.
You speak English?
The man nodded.
Yes, the Piranipa tongue. And you learned a bit of the Anangu language while you dreamed. Enough, at least, so you can understand concepts, if not the precise definitions.
What concepts are those?
He gestured to his right, and Brigid looked toward the dancers cavorting around the bonfire. She realized, with a distant sense of shock, the sounds she had attributed to drums were made by sticks in the hands of the musicians as they struck them together to keep a beat. The piping, skirling notes were produced by hollow logs called didgeridoo, and the ceremonial dance was a korobori, a plea to the spirits of the great creator heroes for help.
My name is Yindi. I'm a practitioner of the Anguiltha.
Magic. That would make you a shaman or sorcerer.
Yindi shrugged his knobby shoulders.
No less a sorcerer than you, who can fly through dream time without the ritual of Ripiri, the purification. Truly, Waramungundi, the Great Mother, brought you here.
Brigid didn't address his statement directly.
What about my friends?
They slept and dreamed as you did.
But I woke up.
As shall they.
As soon as the last word left Yindi's lips, Brigid heard sounds of stirring from within the lean-to, little muffled gasps of commingled surprise and fright. Within a few seconds, Shizuka and Domi crept out. Neither one of them appeared to be overly bewildered, so Brigid figured they had received the same history lesson during the interfacer transit as she had. Domi always felt an affinity for primitive people, so she seemed particularly at ease.
What is going on?
Brigid gestured to Yindi.
That's what I want to know. Maybe we should all introduce ourselves first.
Names were exchanged all around, and Yindi nodded to each one respectfully.
On behalf of the Great Mother, I welcome you, and thank you for heeding her call.
Facing him, Shizuka smoothly arranged her legs in a lotus position.
What makes you so sure she brought us here?
A smile touched Yindi's lips, and he cast his gaze skyward.
The eyes of Waramungundi have foretold your arrival for many days.
Brigid, Shizuka, and Domi followed his upward stare, and for a long moment they saw nothing but the star-speckled tapestry of the sky, turning gray on the horizon as dawn approached. Then their breaths caught in their throats when the leathery rustling of great wings reached their ears. Dark shapes soared above them, blotting out the stars. They could only catch glimpses of their features, but they saw long, narrow-snouted heads, the mouths full of wolfish fangs. Huge wings scalloped at the edges and stretched over bony frames, swept down to wiry legs that terminated in talon-tipped prehensile feet. Brigid guessed the wings at full extension would measure some 18 feet from tip to tip.
Kso! Zakanayo! What are they? Bats. Giant, mutated fruit bats. They used to be called flying foxes.
The first two or three generations of mutant animals born in the aftermath of the new cost had run toward polyploidism, a doubling or tripling of the chromosome complement. For a time, gargantuan species of mammal and even reptiles had roamed the world, but their increased size had greatly reduced their lifespans. Only a few of the giant varieties existed any longer. Certainly by the time Brigid was born, most of them were extinct. Yindi didn't dispute Brigid's identification of the flying creatures.
They have been spying on the defilers of Mount Uluru, reporting to us their strength and their numbers. The woman you seek is among them.
We know as much. How do you know that?
A flame seemed to ignite in Yindi's eyes.
The Great Mother speaks to me. She weeps for the sacrilege done to her holy womb. She bade me curse the defilers, and so I did. I spoke the ancient words and pointed the bone. They have been dying ever since, but to complete the curse, I have been awaiting the instruments of Waramungundi.
Let me guess, you think that's us?
I do not think. I know. The spirits of our ancestors are linked to Mount Uluru, and we are linked to our ancestors. The Mount was ancient, even in our oldest histories. Yes, much of the old way has been lost, but we do not mourn it. Instead, we have devoted our lives to preserving what survived the Pocklips. We can do no less to honor our ancestors.
Brigid remembered the brief vision of the snake people and their unmistakable resemblance to the Anunnaki.
Where do your legends say your ancestors went?
Yindi answered Brigid's question with a long, convoluted story of dark and mysterious matters, of Waramurungundi conjuring magic from within Mount Uluru. Although Brigid was always interested in legend and myth, she was more impressed by the manner in which Mount Uluru still exerted a terrible elemental power over the Aborigines. It filled their whole lives. The Dreamtime Decree was the cohesive force that kept the Aborigines in harmony with their land for over 50,000 years. Since they were part of the land, they couldn't understand why anyone would want to defile it, particularly a sacred site like Mount Uluru. To Yindi, it was tantamount to destruction of the life force itself. When Yindi paused for breath, Shizuka raised a peremptory hand.
We wish only to rescue our missing friend, not act as instruments of the Great Mother's curse.
You cannot do one without the other. The heart of the Great Mother beats within Uluru, the life force of our people.
Will you help us?
Of course.
How?
I can show you dreamtime paths by which you will arrive within the heart of Waramungundi, and our enemies will be unaware of your presence.
Actually, our enemies expect somebody to show up, so we won't exactly catch them by surprise.
Yindi leaned back on his haunches, and a wide smile split his face.
I think we will.
A rose-pink sun inched over the rim of the world, splashing the sky with variegated scraps of color. By the time it was a finger's width above the horizon, Brigid figured they had walked about 5 miles. Vegetation sprouted from the sand, scraggly leaves moving slightly in the breeze. She, Shizuka, Domi, and Yindi strode swiftly across the arid ground, through thickets full of shrubbery with steely thorns. The wind-drifted sand glimmered in long red ripples. The ground wasn't smooth, although it looked deceptively so. All of them but the barefoot Yindi stumbled at least once on the sharp creases of rock hidden by siftings of sand. The soles of his feet were thickly calloused. The sun grew red and menacing as it climbed higher. By the time it was 3 fingers' width above the edge of the world, the air was heavy with radiating waves of sheer, hellish heat. The desert hardpan seemed to soak it up and reflect it back. There was no shelter in sight from the rising inferno. Domi, fair-skinned and sensitive-eyed, suffered the worst, but she kept her complaints to herself. She quickly soaked her shirt through with perspiration. Yindi gestured for a halt at the base of a rock-strewed dune, then motioned for them to crawl up it. The 3 women did so, Domi and Brigid being careful not to get sand in the slide mechanisms of their blasters. They peered over the crest and saw pretty much what they expected. A long chain of rocky hills curved across the horizon like the fossilized vertebrae of some prehistoric monster. The rocky hills led toward a vast monolithic formation that shouldered the sky. The early morning light played over its domed surface, splashing it with blood-red streaks. Brigid tried to estimate the size of the monstrous monolith, using the hills as a reference point, but she realized Mount Uluru was of such staggering proportions as to make its true distance from the hills difficult to gauge. She figured they were nearly 1/4 mile away. Domi shaded her eyes with her hands.
Now what?
Now the eyes of the Great Mother will do more than simply observe. They will divert the attention of the defilers.
Although Yindi sounded as if he had spoken from directly behind them, when Brigid turned her head, she saw him still standing at the foot of the dune, holding the interphaser in both hands.
What do you mean by that?
Shizuka gestured sharply.
Look!
Brigid looked back toward Mount Uluru and glimpsed darting shapes around the domed top. The shift and blur of dark wings, black against the blue sky. Faintly, borne on the warm breeze, came the cracking reports of multiple gunshots. A grim smile of approval tugged at the corners of Domi's lips.
Those things would divert anybody's attention.
The three women quickly backed down from the crest of the dune and clustered around Yindi.
Now that we've got the diversion, what's your plan?
Yindi hefted the interphaser.
Working in tandem with your mechanism, I will show you how to slip into the flow of Uluru through the Dreamtime paths and return safely.
Sort of like a back alley through space-time?
Yindi frowned.
You mock my beliefs?
Not at all. But I have to point out that we don't know the location of our missing friend, or we could have used our mechanism to deliver us right to her.
Yindi's frown turned into a patronizing smile.
I thought you understood by now. It was the will of Waramungundi that events unfold in this fashion. We are all caught on a wheel from which there is no release but by grace of the Great Mother. We are whirled up into life, the light of day, and carried down again into death, the darkness of night. But then another day dawns red, much like this one, and we are reborn. Death is no release from the wheel, unless the mother should intervene.
Will she intervene now?
Yindi shrugged.
If you had arrived within the womb of the Great Mother in the manner you say, she would not. All of you would have died at the hands of the Defilers. Now, the energy of Uluru will be with you. It will protect you and the one you seek. My belief will speed you on your way.
Domi scowled.
Belief? What does that have to do with anything?
Brigid knew what Yindi referred to, and she also knew neither she nor he could possibly define what he meant. It was the concept of reality as perception. Dreamtime and Uluru were powerful imprints on the minds of the Aborigines, and since they didn't believe they were trapped within the parameters of a mere three dimensions, they knew the distinction between any form of existence, even past, present, and future, was only an illusion. In that, the Aborigines were not that far removed from theoretical physicists. They always sought symmetry. Brigid reached for the interphaser.
I need to program in the destination coordinates.
Yindi didn't relinquish the Pyramidion. His patronizing smile became outright pitying.
I thought I had made myself clear. Waramungundi has already taken care of that.
He stepped back and placed the interphaser on the ground. Brigid stared at him, too confused to ask questions. Yindi passed the flat of his right hand over the apex of the device. Instantly, an ectoplasmic flame sprang up from the tip, stretching out, seeming to follow the movement of his hand.
Now, do you understand?
Although McCloy had known for weeks he was dying, none of his gloomy speculations on the manner of his death had included a blazing dawn full of inhuman howlings and the thrash of wings. Even his field promotion to second lieutenant after the death of Jan had not alleviated his sense of foreboding. He knew some kind of doom would reach out for him, but he hadn't envisioned it stretching down from the sky. McCloy, Kavanaugh, and Franklin had been walking sentry among the crags and clefts atop Ayers Rock. With the achingly slow arrival of sunrise, they had looked forward to nothing more dangerous than being relieved and climbing down to a dining hall improvised from a cavern, having a bite to eat, then sacking out in the barracks. At the onset of the new day, none of the three men expected a swarm of winged monsters to wheel out of the sky. Kavanaugh was the first to warn them about the attack, and he did so by shrieking in mortal anger. McCloy and Franklin were stunned by the sudden, savage, thundering rush of wings. They glimpsed only a horrific shape, swooping away with Kavanaugh writhing within the clutch of cruel claws. When they saw a drizzle of blood speckling the rock at their feet, McCloy and Franklin broke the chains of shock and began firing their SIG AMTs. The first fusillade was the most effective. One of the giant bat things howled in pain as it snapped at the crimson-leaking hole in its furred body before plummeting from the sky. Then the creatures dived and swooped all around them until the soldiers were buffeted constantly by the shock of their passage. McCloy managed to press the chicken switch on his transcom a fraction of a second before the tip of a wing knocked the instrument from his hand. He didn't know if he had activated the alarm, since he could hear nothing but gunfire, high-pitched howls, and the incessant beat of leathery wings. Then he heard something else, a hoarse scream from Franklin. McCloy turned to see curved talons sinking into his partner's neck and wolf-like fangs gorging deep in his midsection. McCloy echoed the man's scream with one of his own, but it was filled with mindless terror as the monster flapped aloft with Franklin kicking feebly within the prison of its claws. Blue-sheened intestines trailed away from the man's torso like a ghastly banner. When McCloy felt warm, thick drops of crimson raining onto his face, his last tenuous grip on courage slipped. He raced toward a shelf of rock, squirmed feet first under it, found the ladder with his groping feet, and pushed himself down into the vertical shaft. His descent down the ladder was more of a controlled fall than a climb. His hands and feet missed several of the rungs, and when he landed at the bottom, it was flat on the soles of his boots. Sharp pains shot through his ankles, the twin impacts jacking both knees up into his lower belly. Over the woofing explosion of violently expelled air, he heard the wail of the alarm siren. Falling over onto his left side, McCloy tried to drag air into his emptied lungs. Troopers were pounding toward him, all of them brandishing auto blasters. They shouted questions at him, but McCloy could only gesture toward the ladder and snap at air. They tramped past him, over him, even on top of him. Forcing himself to his elbows, breath rasping in and out of his straining lungs, McCloy dragged himself away from the ladder so he wouldn't be an obstacle. He pulled off his helmet as he crawled toward a recessed archway in the cavern wall, hoping to get out of the way of the Imperial soldiers. Before he reached it, a light sprang up from within it, seeming to sprout from the floor. It stretched upward in a column, then expanded into a shimmering fan shape. He gaped at it, wheezing, his thought processes frozen. A yellow nova of brilliance erupted from the archway. McCloy felt a shockwave slapping his face. His eyes stung fiercely. He knuckled his eyes, and through the blurred afterimage of the flare, he saw three dark, shadowy shapes shifting in the fan of light. The shadow shapes looked distorted, as if they approached from a great distance, elongated and strangely silhouetted by a sun he couldn't see. The edges of the light seemed to peel back and fragment. A trio of human figures stepped out of nowhere and stood in the archway. Below, the glowing funnel disappeared back into the cavern floor, as if it were liquid and had been sucked down by the rock. Domi took in their surroundings with one swift glance, made a split-second threat assessment, then bounded forward to kick the black-clad man in the chest with her left foot and knock his autoblaster aside with the right. The man's eyes gazed up at her, glassy and full of pain, his lips writhing over his teeth in a silent question. By the time Shizuka and Bridget reached them, Domi's combat master was aligned with the soldier's head.
On your feet!
Slowly and carefully, the man pushed himself erect, his eyes darting from the bore of Domi's pistol to the unsheathed swords held by Shizuka to the copperhead in Bridget's hands.
What's your name?
McCloy.
Well, McCloy, if you tell us what we want to know, you'll live through this. We're looking for a woman.
McCloy shook his head.
No women here, except for the Baron and the Imperial Mother.
Bridget's mind raced.
Imperial Mother?
McCloy only nodded.
Who is that? He can only mean Erica Van Sloan. But who is the woman Baron?
Baron Beausoleil.
Domi pushed the bore of her pistol against his chest.
Where are they?
McCloy swallowed hard.
I really don't know.
Bridget gestured with the copperhead.
Take us to where they might be.
As McCloy started to step forward, Shizuka laid the edge of her tanto against the base of his neck.
Play us false and you die.
McCloy led them through several dimly lit rooms. Domi walked close to Bridget.
Don't like being here without the interfacer.
Bridget nodded.
Me either. But we have to trust that Yindi can control the vortex nodes in here like he claims.
McCloy pushed open a heavy sliding door that led into a corridor that ran in a long, gradual zigzag past another doorway, like the one they had just stepped through. Within a natural recessed niche, a little finger of glowing light danced like witchfire. McCloy stared at it as they passed, but didn't ask questions. The man seemed to be in a state of shock. He stepped before the next door and pushed it open.
The mess hall for the unit is down here.
Domi and Bridget looked around suspiciously, their guns at the ready, but they followed the man into a large room full of tables and benches. McCloy marched across the hall swiftly. They moved through a doorway on the far side and into a cavern that was buttressed at intervals by thick pillars. From the ceiling dangled large hooks on chains that stretched down from traveling hoists. The room was packed with crates. Bridget repressed a shudder.
This is the woman's cave.
McCloy blinked at her.
Yeah, that's right. How did you know?
Bridget only shook her head and pushed him forward. The cave went on for 100 feet, then reached a junction point, 3 passages radiating off like the spokes of a wheel. At the mouth of each tunnel, numbers 1 through 3 were painted in red on the floor.
Now what?
The alarm suddenly stopped wailing. The sudden cessation of the shriek was almost as nerve-wracking as the sound itself.
It appears the diversion has been dealt with.
Domi grabbed a handful of McCloy's tunic and pushed him into a passage.
We've wasted enough time. I'll go with him. You two take the other tunnels. Let's meet back here.
Bridget opened her mouth to voice an objection, then shrugged. Shizuka gave her a rueful smile and chose a tunnel more or less at random. Bridget watched her go, then swiftly entered a passage. She had walked less than 50 yards when she heard the murmur of voices ahead of her and the scuff and scutter of feet. Bridget flattened against the wall, waiting and listening. She heard a woman's voice speaking sharply and imperiously, then a male mumbling a response. In the passage between 2 archways, a pair of men appeared in white uniform jackets, red trousers, and black polished knee boots. Although she had never seen one, Kane had once described baronial guardsmen to her. As a general rule, magistrates held baronial guardsmen in contempt because their duties consisted of strutting around, opening doors, and sneering at the infrequent visitor seeking an audience with a baron. Kane had learned the hard way guardsmen were products of bioengineering and were anything but mere servants. These 2 guardsmen were identically trim and blue-eyed, though one had blonde hair and the other black. They made up for the color difference by styling their hair the same way. Both of their faces were clear of complexion, subtly sculpted to be the epitome of male beauty. Walking between them was a tall woman who Bridget saw was close to the epitome of female beauty. She had only seen her once before, but she recognized her instantly. Bridget stepped out into the center of the passageway, Copperhead held in such a way that she could catch both guardsmen with a left-to-right pattern of fire, with little chance of the rounds ricocheting off the rock.
Dr. Erica Van Sloan, the Imperial Mother.
The guardsmen came to an immediate halt, shifting position to completely block Erica Van Sloan from target acquisition. Their eyes widened and slitted in unison. Peering over the broad bulk of their shoulders, Sloan gazed at Bridget steadily. Her reaction was not what Bridget had expected. She laughed.
Did I say something funny?
Not really. It's just I had pretty much convinced myself the plan to entrap Mohandas had failed. Now here you are. Who came with you? Kane? Grant?
Neither.
The woman's violet eyes slitted.
You didn't come alone.
Bridget shook her head.
I didn't say I did. But Kane and Grant are safe with Lakesh.
Oh. Then they'll be along shortly.
I'm afraid not. They were injured by the energy backlash of Sam's wormhole. If you were hoping to hold me hostage or use me as a pawn, you'll have to come up with another strategy.
Sloan glowered at her.
I don't believe you.
Bridget waggled the noise suppressor of the Copperhead suggestively.
I don't care if you do or don't. You know why I'm here. Take me to her.
Sloan stepped back, raising an imperious hand.
Abbott, Costello, get rid of this arrogant bitch.
Bridget squeezed the trigger, firing a 3-round burst. The guardsman moved swiftly. 2 of the 3 rounds caught the black-haired man on his right shoulder. Straps of tunic exploded in a clot of blood. Erica Van Sloan screamed something incoherent, but by her tone, she was both outraged and frightened. The guardsman stumbled, his arms windmilling, and the man regained his balance. He and his brother guardsmen exchanged long looks. Then they rushed toward Bridget. She had little time to think and even less to act. Swiftly, she took the flashbang stun grenade from her combat harness, pulling the pin and slipping off the spoon all in one smooth motion. She threw the bomb toward the guardsman, and it landed directly in their path. She squeezed her eyes shut a shaved sliver of a second before a stunning, painfully loud thunderclap battered in her ears. A blazing nova of dazzling white light accompanied the teeth-jarring concussion of compressed air. When she opened her eyes, she saw the men reeling in agonized shock, hands either clapped over blinded eyes or cradling hemorrhaging ears. Erica Van Sloan was nowhere in sight. Bridget moved forward, sidling past the pair of guardsmen. A hand closed around her right arm. It felt like a steel vise, painfully crushing muscle and tendon against bone. The guardsman jerked and hammered her against the opposite wall. Bridget managed to go with the force of the throw, cushioning the impact with forearms and hands, trying to cover the left side of her head. Over the past 2 years, she had been involved in any number of life-threatening situations, and she still didn't know if she'd survived them through luck, divine intervention, or simply the proper management and application of skills to circumstances. Although she had taken pains to develop survival and fighting skills, the deranged Otto Skorzeny had inflicted a serious injury to her skull. Now she found herself almost unconsciously overprotecting that side of her head. The blonde guardsman groped for her blindly. Brigid lifted her copperhead and drove the butt forward from the shoulder in a fast, flat trajectory. The metal stock impacted like a battering ram against the bottom tip of the man's nose. It was a faint, mushy crunch of cartilage. Like a skier catching a low branch under the chin, the man's head snapped back, his legs flying out from under him. His crushed nose spewed blood as bone splinters pushed through his sinus cavities and into his brain. The baronial guardsman was dead before his body settled. The dark-haired guardsman whirled, his hands clawing empty air for her. She dropped flat on her left side, sweeping her right leg out in a slashing kick, catching the man just behind the knees. His legs buckled and he staggered, but he didn't fall. In the short span of time it took the Imperial soldier to recover his balance, Brigid had her hands on her copperhead and she worked the trigger, firing a tri-burst into the man's head. Part of his scalp floated away amid a misting of blood. As his body sagged, Brigid rolled to her feet and broke into a sprint, picking up the chase for Erica Van Sloan. She had barely taken 3 strides when her transcom chirped. Pulling it from her harness and opening the frequency, she heard Domi's breathless voice.
Found her, but we can't afford to overstay.
At that moment, the alarm siren began wailing again. McCloy led Domi down a corridor that was dimly lit by overhead bulbs encased in wire cages. The passageway was lined with numbered doors.
What's this area?
Private quarters. For officers and important people.
Domi forced McCloy to knock on each door, and if he received a response, to identify himself by his name and rank. McCloy did as he was told, but no one called out from the rooms. At the last door, McCloy rapped on it and started to turn away when a feminine voice spoke.
Yes?
Domi nodded shortly and gestured with her combat master for McCloy to open the door. He did so, pushing it open slowly. Domi stayed out of sight, the bore of her pistol pressed against the small of his back. He stiffened.
I think this is the woman you've been looking for.
Pulling him back, Domi peered around the frame and saw Quavel sitting in a chair, calmly eating little cubes that resembled foam rubber. A plate resting on the floor beside her contained a number of crumpled paper wrappers. A curse started up Domi's throat, then she saw the chain leading from Quavel's right wrist to an eyebolt affixed to the wall. Knowing for certain that she was a prisoner made her almost as relieved as seeing her alive. When Domi stepped into the cell, Quavel's hand froze as it lifted a food cube to her lips. Domi enjoyed the expression of surprise that crossed her usually mask-like face. Domi turned back to McCloy.
Get in here!
McCloy shook his head.
Sorry, I can't.
Domi glared at him.
What do you mean you can't?
A slender, dark-haired woman wearing a black uniform identical to his slipped around McCloy. A short-barreled pistol was nestled in her delicate right hand, but it wasn't pointed at Domi. The barrel was on a direct line with Quavel.
Drop your weapon.
Domi didn't move or otherwise react.
This is Baron Beausoleil.
Domi refused to allow the astonishment welling up in her to register on her face. A female baron wasn't a concept she had ever entertained.
Do it, or I'll kill Quavel and her child, and then kill you.
Domi slowly lowered her pistol, placing it on the floor at her feet. The baron jabbed the pistol in her direction.
Turn around!
The albino girl complied. The baron stepped into the cell, and when Domi felt the cold tip of the gun touch the back of her neck, she stepped backward, stamping down hard with her foot on the woman's instep, pivoting on it with all her weight, her hand sweeping back to chop at the gun. She knocked it askew. Baron Beausoleil uttered a half-scream as Domi hooked her left fist into her body. Starting from her hip, the punch hinged the woman in the middle and her mouth and eyes flew wide open. Latching onto her right forearm with both hands, Domi snapped up a knee as if the Baron's arm were a stick of kindling she intended to break in two. Baron Beausoleil uttered a gagging shriek and the pistol fell to the floor. Domi shifted her hold, trying to get her into a hammerlock and force her face down on the floor. She had struggled with hybrids in the past, and she assumed it wouldn't require much effort to lay the woman out. The Baron surprised her, first by wriggling out of her grip, then by headbutting her in the lower belly with such force she felt bile leap up in her throat. The Baron's hands lashed out, sharp fingernails sinking her eyes. Domi slapped them aside and found herself battling less of a woman than a crazed animal. The Baron's hands clutched her around the throat, the thumbs seeking her larynx. Prying on the woman's wrists, Domi managed to break Baron Beausoleil's mercilessly choking grip. The Baron fainted to the left, then leaped to the right, pivoted, and swung her left leg up and around in a pretty fair crescent kick. Domi surged forward in the opposite direction. The Baron's foot grazed her head, but she slammed against her, grabbing a handful of silky black hair. Both women fell heavily, the Baron striking her head against the floor. The Baron struggled and heaved and gouged savagely at Domi's eyes. She grasped Domi beneath the chin, her long nails raking at her face. The albino girl sank her teeth into Baron Beausoleil's thumb. With a twist and sideways wrench of her whole body, Baron Beausoleil managed to shove Domi to one side. She rolled and came swiftly to her feet, planting a boot on the side of her adversary's head as she tried to rise. Domi went with the force of the kick, back somersaulted to her feet, and rushed her. The Baron rammed the crown of her head forward, trying to butt her face into the back of her skull. Dodging, Domi kicked out with one long leg, clipping Baron Beausoleil at ankle level. The woman fell, caught herself on the flats of her hands, and swiveled around, kicking Domi's already tender midsection. As she stumbled, the Baron sprang to her feet and launched a left hook. Domi shunted the blow aside with a right arm sweep, then brought her left fist up fast, connecting with the underside of the Baron's jaw. The uppercut snapped the woman's head back. Arms windmilling, she toppled and fell almost at Quavel's feet. Quavel gathered the slack of her chain in one hand and whipped the metal links against the back of the Baron's head. She crumpled to the floor in a senseless, slack-limbed heap. Domi gave Quavel a quick smile and retrieved her pistol. She inspected the bracelet around Quavel's wrist, then visually traced the chain to the eyebolt in the wall. She raised her combat master.
Cover your ears!
Quavel barely had time to follow Domi's suggestion before she squeezed the trigger. A 45 caliber wrecking ball punched a crater in the wall, knocking loose the eyebolt with a spurt of rock dust. Domi drew out her transcom and keyed in Bridget's and Shizuka's frequencies.
Found her, but we can't afford to overstay.
At that moment, the alarm siren began wailing again. As the siren seemed to scream directly in her ear, Shizuka whirled on the ball of one foot and came up with a two-handed stroke. With a faint, wet sound, the blade sliced the soldier's right arm off just below the elbow. Coming up from under his armpit without ceasing her movement, she circled back, the katana flashing in her hands. The trooper's head fell from his shoulders, his mouth open and moving as if it had one last thing it wanted to say. The head rolled across the cavern floor like an awkward ball. The severed neck spouted a scarlet foaming fountain from the opened arteries. Shizuka pivoted, her katana and tanto cutting glittering wheels through the dim light of the junction. She closed on a trooper just as he raced out of a passageway. The edge of her blade sank into the man's jaw at the high collar of his tunic. It wasn't a particularly powerful blow, but sufficient to open up the man's throat in a jetting stream of crimson. She continued to glide gracefully, even as she struck, moving around him as if performing a dance step. The trooper made a peculiar croaking sound, then blood bubbled up in a precise line across his torso. The cut was from the juncture of the neck just above the seventh vertebrae. Then, through the collarbone, angling to the sternum, slicing through the cartilage and spinal column. The man slid wetly in two pieces to the ground. Shizuka looked at the two dead men and tried to catch her breath. She had been waiting for Brigid, Domi, and Quavel for the last minute in the junction where the tunnels met. The passage that led back the way they had come had been disgorging the black-uniformed Imperial soldiers for the last 30 seconds. Running footfalls commanded her attention, and a trio of troopers sprinted out of the passage. They jolted to shocked halts when they caught sight of her. Shizuka raised her swords, crossing them to fashion an X. The three men could only goggle at her, even though they were armed with spidery-looking autoblasters. In that half-second of confusion and disbelief, Shizuka's right-handed tanto sliced through a man's neck, and blood spattered across the cheek of the soldier standing next to him. As he reeled away, trying to staunch the scarlet streams squirting through his fingers, Shizuka advanced on the two black-uniformed and helmeted men, sweeping her swords in elaborate figure-eight patterns. They backed away as she approached, then they turned and ran. Shizuka permitted herself a cold smile of satisfaction and resumed her place in the center of the junction. Within a moment, Bridget appeared, panting and wincing as if in pain. As soon as Shizuka caught sight of her, Domi and Quavel emerged from the mouth of the passageway directly opposite her. Bridget swept her eyes over the glittering pools of blood on the floor and the maimed corpses.
You can't do one without the other. Waramurungundi ought to be pleased.
Domi was half-supporting Quavel.
I know I am. At least if we can get out of here by the way Yindi promised.
I think we can take his word for it.
Bridget eyed Quavel closely.
Are you all right?
Quavel seemed too bewildered to speak.
I do not understand why you risked your lives to save mine.
Bridget took her by the arm and hustled her toward the tunnel.
It's not saved yet.
It's a girl thing.
Wavell looked at her, her expression puzzled.
Again, I don't understand.
Bridget smiled at her.
It's what we do, Quavell. After you've been with us a couple of years, you'll get it.
Quavell gazed at her, then shook her head.
It will take more than a couple of years.
The chill that came with nightfall set Mammoth Mare McSqueen's teeth to chattering, but she walked on. The wind had veered during the day, blowing down from the north and bringing unseasonably cold breezes gusting across the hills. Mare walked alone, having been deserted once and for all by her crew the day before. Not only had they abandoned her, they also took her beloved Mossberg rifle with them. Then they had scattered, but shortly thereafter she spied at least half a dozen deathbirds cutting search patterns across the sky. She knew they were looking for her crew, so she didn't mind that they had left her. Most of them had stayed together and offered easy targets for the mags. She tramped through a gully, and there was enough light from the rising moon peeping from behind ragged clouds to light her way. The trail became rockier and more treacherous as it wound around steep ravines. The detonation of thunder boomed in the distance, a long, loud roll. Mare scanned the sky and saw billowing clouds massing above the jagged peaks of hills, less than a couple of miles away. The underside of the clouds bore a sickly green tinge, undershot by a salmon pink. Fingers of dread closed about her heart at the prospect of being trapped out in the open by a chemstorm. She quickened her pace, even though the footing was uncertain. There was another flash of lightning, intimidatingly close. Mare could feel her body hair tingle and stand up. The thunderclap followed almost immediately. She smelled the sharp sting of acid in the air and knew the storm would be a bad one. Then, when lightning flashed again, she saw the dark mouth of a cave only a few yards ahead of her. Mare quickened her pace, but she didn't immediately enter. Cupping her hands around her eyes, she peered into the shapeless darkness. She sniffed the air, but didn't detect the musky scent of an animal. Cautiously, she took a step forward. Then, from the blackness ahead of her, she heard a voice.
So, you found me at last.
Mare halted, but didn't say anything. Her eyes scanned the darkness, expecting at any instant to hear a gunshot and feel the hot hammer of lead pounding into her body. When it didn't happen, she took a couple of more steps into the cave, straining her ears and eyes, but it was too dark to make out anything.
I'm not looking for anyone. I just want to get out of the storm.
Where are you from?
Nowhere in particular. Who are you?
This is my place. I ask the questions. Do you have a name?
Of course I do! It's Mary Lou! How about you? Do you have a name?
Name? I had a title, which is more important than a name.
Mare felt her nape hairs tingling. She heard the scuff of shambling feet. From the shadows limped a gaunt, man-shaped figure with unusually long arms. He appeared to be naked, his body covered with leaking sores and discolored lesions. The man's face was in dark shadow, but Mare was able to glimpse a long, narrow visage and a round, hairless skull that seemed just a bit too large.
I was Baron Cobalt, and I command you to do one of two things. Help me live, or help me die.
Outlander's Far Empire is a Graphic Audio production. Outlanders and all characters are trademarks owned by Harlequin Enterprises Limited, used by others under license. Copyright 2002, Worldwide Library, all rights reserved. Production copyright 2005, The Cutting Corporation, all rights reserved. Performed by Terrence Aselford, Nanette Savard, Thomas Penny, Richard Rowan, and Colleen Delaney. Additional red shirts by The Dead Giveaways. Directed by Terrence Aselford. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing by Nathaniel Perry and Brian Rogers. Graphic audio sound design by Chris Rowan and Brian Rogers. The Outlander's theme was composed by Norman Vandersleis. If you enjoyed Outlanders, be sure to look for James Axler's Deathlands, available at road stops everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our Action Pump titles, as well as free downloadable extras, forums, and podcasts. Keep listening for a preview of another Graphic Audio title.
The following preview is of a Graphic Audio production rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations.
Available now from Graphic Audio.
Deathlands 61, Skydark Spawn.
Ready?
The crowd screamed its approval.
Fight!
As Brody had suggested, Mog and his men went after Hambly, allowing Richmond the chance to go after Ryan. Brody made sure Dorfman, Billingsley, and Foghat remained with Mog and didn't try to take out Ryan amid the confusion.
You're good with a knife, Cyclops.
Better to be quick with a knife than quick with my mouth.
Richmond was a tall, lanky man. Ryan estimated they weighed about the same, but Richmond stood about 3 inches taller. Unlike the knife scars he'd seen on other Sekhmet enslaves here, Richmond had a big, round blaster scar on his right shoulder that was about 3 inches across. The wound was set back in the flesh about an inch, as if someone had scooped out a patch of flesh with a knife.
You want me to put down the knife, Cyclops?
Ryan shrugged.
No problem.
Richmond dropped his knife onto the ground and kicked it to the edge of the circle. Meanwhile, Mog and his three men had Hambly, the mutie, surrounded. Billingsley was poking him with his pike, while Foghat was slashing at his back with his sword. There was pale red blood flowing over the mutant's equally pale flesh, making him look like a pre-dark barber's pole. Every once in a while, Hambly would make a break for the circle's edge, but Mog would always catch him and pull him back for still more torture. As Ryan was dealing with Richmond, he noticed what was going on out of the corner of his eye and knew he'd have no trouble chilling Mog when the time came. He was too careless and casual in his way, and Ryan would take full advantage of it when the time came. He looked back at Richmond and threw his panga to the ground, where the tip dug into the hard, dry earth and stuck, leaving the handle to quiver slightly in the sun.
I'll get more pleasure chilling you with my bare hands anyway. That way it'll happen slowly and with plenty of pain.
Ryan said nothing, concentrating solely on Richmond's hands and feet. Dorfman, one of Mog's cronies, wandered over toward Richmond and Ryan, looking for a chance to chill one of them while they fought. But Brody stepped forward, waving the sharp end of his pike in Dorfman's face, and the man backed off. Richmond lunged at Ryan, but the one-eyed man was able to move left out of the way. Richmond turned, a slight smile on his face, then lunged again, this time feigning left, then moving right. Ryan again stepped to the side, but this time as Richmond passed him, he put out a knee, catching the Sekh man in the thigh and sending him spinning to the ground. Richmond spat dust and dirt from his mouth and rolled onto his back, expecting Ryan to be right there towering over him. But Ryan was standing well back, waiting for the Sekh man to regain his feet.
You'll be sorry you didn't try to finish me off, Cyclops.
I'll make you the same offer I made your friend. If you leave at the next break, I won't kill you.
Richmond said nothing for several seconds, then began to laugh.
You're gonna spare my life, slave?
I'm no slave.
Richmond grabbed a handful of dirt and dust and threw it in Ryan's face. The one-eyed man had been expecting as much from the Sekh man and turned his head to the right, causing the grit to sting his face and fall harmlessly against the patch over his left eye. Ryan moved in, not giving the downed Sekh man any more time to get back to his feet. But before he could get his hands on Richmond, the man had a knife in his right fist. He gave it a flick, and a 4-inch blade appeared, as if out of the air. The crowd had noticed Richmond's weapon and realized he had brought it into the ring with him. They began to boo and throw rotten food and vegetables into the circle. Ryan was hit in the back by an overripe tomato. Grunwald got up from his chair, looking as if he might stop the fighting or force Richmond to drop his weapon, but the Baron motioned for Grunwald to sit down, then waved his hands, signaling that the combatants continue their fight. Ryan ducked low and kicked at Richmond's feet, sending the Sec man spinning onto his back. Without hesitation, he kicked him again, this time hard in the stomach. Richmond sputtered and coughed up a mouthful of bile, but still managed to slash at Ryan's leg, splitting the fabric of his pant leg open at the knee. Brody moved in with his pike to pin the Sec man down, but Ryan waved him off.
I don't need your help. Just watch my back.
The crowd roared its approval and turned its attention away from Mog's battle with Hambly.
If you can't find that hot graphic audio title you're looking for, just head to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD or MP3 disc format. Or, the fastest and cheapest way, download that puppy and play it on any of the many devices that'll play Windows Media. And if you're on the road or just a total computer feeb, snatch up the phone and call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220 or www.graphicaudio.net.